Major Mills, Reel 5. Before we go on, there's just one thing I should have asked them, which is this thing about dropping from Whitley's, because they don't come up again, so we just drop it in here, so to speak. What was this about ringing the bell? What was it? Were you warned about it? Can you explain it?
Yes, you try to go through the whole completely central. If you mismanage that drop, the slipstream can catch you before you've gone through and bang your chin on the side of the hole. And when that happens, it normally leaves you feeling, and it didn't happen to me, but people say it made you feel pretty dizzy. And the accident is called ringing the bell. The other thing that can happen in the same context is that as you go out, the slipstream catching your feet can chuck them up into the air and cause you to somersault between your lift webs. That never happened to me, but there again, it happened to quite a number of people.
Right, we'll move on now. You were saying that something happened, amazing happened.
Yes, Martin Lindsay wanted to introduce a scheme of the battalion in defence, and he set out a most elaborate sand table model and got all the officers together one afternoon, and he went through all the bits, and he insisted, he said, "You will regard this as the cat's whiskers. You will like it and you will do it." And he said, "Mills, I know that you haven't come directly from a machine gun battalion, but it was a machine gun regiment. What about the machine guns?" I said, "Excuse me, sir, I've been handling Vickers since I was a boy of 15. So I said my bit, which I can't really remember, and then he said, "You will take command of the machine gun platoon right away." So the officer commanding machine gun platoon, Lieutenant Dixon, was away for weeks on end. So for several weeks, I took command of the I moved from B Company and took up command of the machine gun platoon. And I enjoyed that very much. Now,
how would the machine gun platoon land its Vickers? I mean,
the Vickers were landed in containers and they were moved on useless barrows. The barrows were two-wheeled trolleys with a canvas body, and they were they folded, they collapsed. And they used to collapse when you used them. They were terrible things. It's much better to get the tripod across a bloke's shoulders, get the gun across a bloke's shoulders, and go for it.
And the dropping, these containers would have their own parachute. They'd just be thrown out.
Oh, they have their own parachute. Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah. Now, this was when I first came to be really under the orders of Terence Osprey, who was second in command. We had an exercise, and he was commanding the battalion on this occasion, and he came up to me and said, "Bill, where are your guns?" I said, "Right behind me, sir." He said, "Right, I want fire there and I want fire here." I said, "Right, sir." And I got on and I produced the fire he wanted. Now, I realized that this man was a delegator. He never once told you how to do something. He just told you the result he needed. And I realized that he's a very tough cookie, but I could work with him. Very tough cookie.
What was he like? Can you sort of flesh him out a bit for us?
Yeah, he's wiry, Irish descent. Doesn't stand any excuses for people not doing their job properly. Can be very, very terse in his command. Can be very, very pleasant. On the whole, an extremely capable soldier.
Now, the other, I mean, he was a major then, second in command. But yeah. What about Colonel, is it Martin Lindsay?
Colonel Martin Lindsay.
Can you describe what he was like?
He was on the same. Martin Lindsay was a man who had a Polar Medal. He'd done one or two expeditions to the North Pole. very successfully. He was hard as nails. He was kind to you, but he showed, and everybody feared, that he had a complete disregard for loss of life. Things he asked people to do on manoeuvres, on rehearsals, on schemes, you could see in reality could end up a appalling loss of life. Now, Terence Otway was always doing things to save lives. And anyway,
how did they get on together? That's a very big difference.
People say that they didn't get on too well, but I found myself completely in the middle of Martin Lindsay's leaving the battalion. I couldn't believe it, what had happened, but the battalion was sent home on leave, all except me and my batman and Martin Lindsay. I think my batman even cooked for us. There were only about three of us left. Everybody was sent on leave. And so I took a post in the orderly room, and I was sitting in the orderly room on a Saturday morning when Martin Lindsay walked in. He said, "Bill, I am in arrest. Will you please escort me?" And that was incredible for a subaltern to escort a... because I lost a rank when I switched from infantry to paras. It was for a subaltern to escort a lieutenant colonel. Anyway, he took me back to his room while he packed his kit and told me what had happened. On a previous exercise called, I think it was called Exercise Mush, he and Brigadier Hill, and I hope I'm not slandering anybody on this tape, am I? Because I don't mean to. I'm just telling the facts as I know
them. That's all right.
He and Brigadier Hill had been invited. They stood on the roadside outside a country house, and the lady came out, invited them both to come in for a cup of coffee. And they walked inside, and there was a family group there, two or three people, male and female, country gentry, and they sat down to have their cup of coffee. And the question, the talk of drugs came up, apparently. And Martin Lindsay said, they had to be very careful how they, what precaution they took on truth drugs when Boy Browning was flying over France photographing possible drop zones, because the colonel, as he was then, or was he general then, Browning, did go out into France, had been out in the mosquitoes, looking for dropping zones. And this and he said this in front of these people. And when he came out, James Hill said, "Martin, that was a gross indiscretion, a terrible indiscretion. I have to think about it." And then that would have been that week sometime. The battalion was sent on leave, and that Saturday morning, Brigadier Hill sent for him and told him he was in arrest and to come back to the barracks and pack his kit. So he packed his kit. He was still there through the Sunday. I was finalizing regimental accounts, so I had plenty of work to do, plenty of book work. And he went off to bed on the Sunday night, and I sat up in the anteroom in the mess, fixed up a card table, and went on with my accounting. And about 12:30, Terence Otway came in and said, "I've been told to take command of the battalion immediately." Next morning, Martin Lindsay came into breakfast, very stoic, had his breakfast and departed. Terence sent for the officers middle day and said, "I'm now in command," and he was wearing a colonel's badge of rank. And from that moment, he started to run the battalion. And from my standpoint, it was all right. I think everybody had a great deal of confidence in him. He was competent, he was tough, but he always talked about not wasting lives. So we went on with endless exercises.
Tell me about some of the exercises you went on. Were you allowed to jump at this point?
No, I was not allowed to jump. Now, regarding jumping, I'll tell you what happened. I was immediately said I wanted to get myself upgraded to A. So I was sent along to the local hospital to see a man called Newman, who was a famous escapist and a doctor. And he said there may be some chance of grading you up to A, so you can jump again. So I got the opportunity one Sunday, I don't know how it happened, of doing another parachute jump. I think I told people that it was a test jump to see if my arm was all right. So I went up with one of the companies and dropped out of a Dakota. And I preserved my arm, my shoulder, by taking the landing, by coming in backwards and taking the landing on my bottom and my steel helmet. It was a good way of landing. And my shoulder was fine, so I thought, now I'm going to be A, I can become a normal officer in this outfit. So anyway, I went and saw this bloke again, and meantime I'd had to report back to Bosley's, and they were quite cross. They said, it's all very well for you to drop on Salisbury Plain, but God, if you'd come down in a tree or on a road or something like that, you would have been causing terrible problems. And they wrote a letter saying, this chap has done all he possibly can, but we ourselves at Bosley's cannot agree to his parachuting. And I went and appealed to this army chap, and he said, well, we've got to leave it over to the board. So up came the board, and the head of the board was, the most depressing bloke. He said, the thing you've got to do, get yourself out of the parachute regiment where you won't be such an odd bore. I said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be fit to parachute. I'm sure I am. I have parachuted. So anyway, to cut a long story short, I was graded B permanent, so I could stay with the battalion. Now, Terence Otway immediately gave me back my captaincy, and he did it this way. There were two administrative officers in the battalion in action. There were supposed to be two. He graded the non-jumping captain and the jumping lieutenant. It should have been round the other way, but he got permission to do it. So I was the administrative officer that was going to take the seaborne party to war, and that's the role I played.
So it was a sort of compromise, but you were reasonably happy with it?
Well, the best I could do. At least I was going to get into the action. And at least I was contributing, because, you know, when you add it all up, to do a proper administrative service to a parachute battalion, a hell of a lot of work is involved. And I enjoyed doing it.
So did that mean you lost at that point your Vickers responsibility,
Absolutely.
Your machine gun?
Yeah, not forever.
So when was this, roundabout?
This would be late April, early May, running up to getting organised to go abroad.
Now, what about the early briefings and information you were getting as an officer of D-Day?
All we got was a continuous exercises to attack a battery. Always attacking a German battery.
Now tell me, what were these battery exercises like? Or do you not see much of them in your new role?
Well, I had to get down to the airfield and organise the quarters for the blokes. I had to organise the messing. I had to report to the tower to coordinate with the dispatching authority, the RAF. I had plenty to do. And by that time, I was gathering a few troops around me in the administrative section. I had about 7 or 8 men to help me.
So you gathered you were going to be attacking a battery, but presumably you had no idea where or when.
No, none at all. Now, the battalion then got split. The whole battalion, except the administrative staff, were taken away from Bulford. They went to a destination near Hungerford. And that's right, is it Hungerford or what's the other town down there? I'll have to look it up. Inkpen.
Inkpen, where's that?
Inkpen, it's near Hungerford. They went to Inkpen. And there, I didn't know what was going on, except I went out to Inkpen three or four times a week to take out various supplies, and chaps were always filling up canisters of flamethrowers and all that sort of thing. But apparently, it's come out since, and you'll read about it when I hand you this book. The onslaught, they were learning the onslaught, and night after night after night, they day after day, they attacked in daylight, and night after night, they did a real good rehearsal. They did dozens of rehearsals of attacking this battery, which is an exact model of the Merville battery, but nobody knew it was at Merville. And I kept on clearing up the regimental accounts, and then the next job I had to do was to get that seaborne tail ready. And the biggest job there was to get all the battalion vehicles and get them waterproofed.
And that was, how did you do that?
Well, it was the most amazingly organized show. I don't know whether it was just the brigade vehicles. There were certainly an enormous number of vehicles on a square outside Bulford. And we all lined up, and each vehicle was given its stuff for waterproofing. Rolls and rolls of plastic stuff, rolls and rolls of belting, and all sorts of stuff like that. And an REO, a REMI officer, stood on a dais in front of us all with the most enormous loudspeaker, and he gave order by order. Put so-and-so, so-and-so round your exhaust manifold, and as it did it, a REMI NCO were walking up and down the line and checked it was done. And we were there all day, waterproofing all these vehicles and getting complete okay. The only thing that we couldn't do was to run them around with the muff. It had the ground sheet in front of the bonnet. The ground sheet in front of the bonnet was to stop the shock of the water, putting the engine out of action anyway. But what you had to remember was to get that ground sheet off as soon as you landed, otherwise your engine would overheat. So we got that done.
Did you test the waterproofing in a pond?
There was no testing. The next thing that happened was we were told to stand by to move. Now, at that point, our vehicles were being painted. We had signs allotted to each vehicle, like LH33, TD24, UD, and all that. This all meant upper deck, tween decks, lower deck, and that was worked out in advance. And also, the ship number was on. We didn't know what it meant. All my vehicles were painted MT21. These numbers were given out in Bulford, and they were put on these vehicles. The vehicles had to be loaded with this, that, and the other. I had all the men's kit bags. I had spare clothing. I had officers' whiskey, officers' mess stuff. Oh, enormous number of stores was packed in these wagons. Now, if I remember rightly, my battalion wagons to take out were 6 three-tonners, a water cart, and that was it. I was driving, I hadn't got a Jeep, but just my three-tonner. In fact, I don't remember any Jeeps being taken out by me. The Jeeps could have been dispatched for taking out in gliders. That I can't remember. But I had to concentrate on the seaborne party. In the middle of one night, the brigade DAQMG knocked on my bedroom door, said, "Get out of bed, get your troops out of bed. You've got to you've got to get your drivers to drive straight to Tilbury, and you've got to take your men by train to Tilbury not to Tilbury, I'm sorry, to a transit camp. We went to a transit camp in Essex. I'm just trying to think where it was. It was... where we found ourselves in a barbed wire cage. And funny enough, there's a hole in the wire, so when we wanted to go out for a stroll to a pub, we did it. But we found ourselves at all the administrative sections of the brigade, plus lots of other troops were in this cage with our vehicles. And there was a lot of topping up of things to do there. I can't remember what they were, but they were bringing extra stores in, which we had to put in the vehicles, etc. We got organised.
And this was it, would this actually be into June by this time?
It was into the late part of May.
So that's late May, right?
Yes. And then in the last days of May, we went down to Tilbury. And there we were in front of MT-21, and our vehicles were hauled up and placed inside these troop ships.
MT-21 was the name of the...
It was a Liberty ship. It had gone very well with the American officers. An American ship, gone very well with the American officers. Our chaps started to help them with their... all the administrative chaps I had on board with me, all the order room staff and all the rest of it, stretcher bearers. Everybody that wasn't essential for the drop were with me, and also from the other battalions of the brigade, the Canadians and the rest, and we actually put ourselves on the roster to help the Americans with their anti-aircraft guard at night.
So how did you get on with them? Tell me a bit more about the relationship with the Americans.
It was very good. It was very good indeed. I never had a cross word with any of them, even though I deserved it one day. Because the captain went ashore, and I remember him saying to the first officer, when the tide changes, this was lying offshore, this ship, you see, it got to a point, it was lying offshore in the middle of the Thames, don't use your anchor chain when the tide changes, let her go on her own, do not use the anchor chain. So he went ashore to London in civilian clothes, as did several other officers, and there was the armed guard officer who was in charge of the anti-aircraft guns, myself and the other British officers, plus the next senior ship's officer were there. Well, the tide changed, and this chap disobeyed orders. He swung the ship round on the arm guard, on the anchor, and the captain heard about it. He came on board furious. But what made matters worse was that as the captain was ashore, when we settled down for our supper that evening, the gunnery officer said, sit in the captain's chair. He's not here. We would like you to sit there. So the captain came bursting into the wardroom with this British officer sitting in his chair. Anyway, relations were fine. The next day he came to my cabin and we chatted for ages while I showed him some of our weapons like the brain gun and other things. Quite fascinated him.
What about this this anti-aircraft sort of assisting the crew on the
that? Well, they said
were
they
were there actually
they were
many
they
attacks?
Were Ehrlichans. They were Ehrlichans. And we were asked if some of our chaps could help out the crewing of these Ehrlichans, so we stood two with them. These were never fired until we got off the coast of France. Now, we sat on the ship, and then the convoy started moving downstream. And early in the morning of the 6th of June, we were coming out of the estuary and obviously going along the coast, not far, I would say, from Beachy Head. It seemed like Beachy Head or Dover. Dover. We came under fire from German artillery. Didn't last long. Not very frightening. A few shell bursts around us, but it was coming from the other side, from their big guns. But didn't bother us too much. We got out of their range, and then we just seemed never to stop. We just sailed straight across And
what was it like as you went across? What could you see?
Nothing, because by the time we arrived, it was the following morning. We should be more or less sailed through the night. Now, when we arrived, the captain said for me, and we're off the coast of France, he said, "We're not going in here. I have had orders to take my, to take this flotilla. I've had orders from my flotilla commander to take this ship along the coast up nearer where the American Navy is in operation." Well, I took it that he was afraid. I'm afraid. I took it he was afraid. Nothing we could do about it. So we turned left. Correction, we turned right, and we went up the coast for a hell of a long way until we came in the lee of an American battleship, which was pouring shells into the countryside. And there we dropped anchor. We couldn't get ashore that night because it was very difficult to make contact. Eventually, someone, a Marine officer came aboard. That was our contact to get off the next day. That night, there was an air raid. Our gunners shot down our own barrage balloon. That's all that happened.
What's the trouble about that?
It caused a laugh. next day, which would then be D plus 7, we got ashore. Sorry, D plus 1, 7th of June, we got ashore.
Now, where did you land?
Now, I landed miles out of where I was supposed to land. I landed on the shore side of a town called Crepon. It's a hell of a long way away, about 25 miles down the coast. So all I could do was to use the map. By that time, I got my briefing, by the way, on board the ship. I never got briefed at all until I was on board that ship. And then my briefing came in papers and maps.
Well, tell me what the briefing said.
The briefing was that there was going to be... The division was going to land on the on the east bank of the Orne, and that the 9th Battalion objective was the Merville Battery, and that we were to take our wagons across the bridge of the Orne, which was to be kept intact, and we were to rendezvous in the castle of Benneville. And all of that was perfectly plain, but I had a 25-mile journey across the front in order to achieve it.